Well, I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for this kind invitation. And first day at the meeting yesterday, Brett said that, Taka, you're trying to widen your horizon. Yes, of course, I am trying to widen the horizon. And particularly impressed with the talks the last 2 days to try to get a grip of what this extra organ, I guess, the microbiota, how it interacts intimately with the host. And it reminds me of this Aesop saying that it is with our passions as it is with fire and water. They are good servants, but bad masters. So the microbiome, the way I understand it, are working together with us to cooperate, to have good health, but they do deviate. And that's where we come from. Now, I have no experience in the microbiome, but I'd like to tell you two stories about how I think the microbiome can interact with our immune system, as well as to reprogram some of our cells, and what those could be. And of course, I hope you understand that the talk is, at least for the first part, is purely based on speculation, grasping for the understanding how the microbiome have changed the nutrient milieu. And of course, at first glance, you look at it as there is a metabolic adaptation of the host with the microbiome and what they actually produce. And we heard a lot about butyrate, acetate, and other that came from the fermentation of the bacteria. But there, that interaction is at the level of bioenergetics because it provides more energy to us, and of course it goes both ways as well. And biosynthesis is make new molecules or molecules that you need to grow or not to grow. Very important part, which I would not be able to touch upon, is the redox, because they are, after all, active and could induce oxidative stress. But what are these interactions that we heard so elegantly from different talks, that of Sven Pedersen, for example, and others, that the microbiome can actually reprogram our cells. How do they do that now? And they're involved in development. How do they do that? We heard all about the immune system being involved, but I like to speculate because it reminds me of how the glial cells in our brains and the neurons, they actually form a glial neuronal shuttle system. Can we be thinking of, in this case, a microbiome and host shuttle system, where we talk to each other through molecules which is yet to be identified? We saw a lot of metabolomics, we saw a lot of sequencing. How do they actually add up to do these jobs that we think they're doing? I think in the core of it has to be metabolism at some level, and of course the immune system at a different level. And the way glial cells and neurons work is that they have shadows of receptors, channels that allow these metabolites to be exchanged. And branch-chain amino acids I think they're very important. Alanine, lactate, of course, there we are, of course, talking about the microbiome again at some level, and different amino acids, as well as carbohydrates, etc., etc. But I think, in my mind, there is one molecule which is really very important, that's alpha-ketoglutarate. Alpha-ketoglutarate is an important part of reprogramming that is known for a long time, but it's ignored at that level. And I'll show to you how a recent discovery of a mutation in brain cancers and leukemias and lymphomas have allowed us to rethink that program, how important it is. We know that butyrate is very important, and we heard from the last talk how it could be actually a key driving force that regulate energy metabolism between the microbiome and the host. Because in germ-free mice, there is reduced butyrate due to the lack of fermentation of bacteria, and there's an energy-deprived state. But what struck me is the marked decrease is NADH-NAD ratio, oxidative phosphorylation ATP. Of course, that would lead to the upregulation of AMP, phosphorylation AMPK, P27, in response to the lack of energy, and it goes into autophagy, and how butyrate can actually reverse this germ-free state, to me, is very striking. But I'd like to go back and talk about oxidative phosphorylation and NADPH, because I think that's key, at least in my mind. Oxidative phosphorylation, of course, happens in the mitochondria, and glucose is taken up to glucose-6-phosphate, become pyruvate. Pyruvate becomes acetyl-CoA. And this TCA cycle, very key step, is a step isocitrate dehydrogenase, which takes isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, both in the cytosol and in the mitochondria. ICDH1, which is in the cytosol, which converts isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, requires the consumption of cofactor and generates a redox, which is very important, but I'm not going to talk about that today. And these two are important because I think they generate the alpha-ketoglutarate, that, which is important for the reprogramming of a cell. And IDH1 is actually not present in a lot of different tissues, but very importantly for this particular audience and your interest, it is in the liver where it's very important. It's in the gut where it's very important, but it's very, very highly expressed also in white adipose tissues and brown adipose tissue. And this is not actually present in a lot of other tissues. Of course, we all have IDH2 in the mitochondria. Now, why is alpha-ketoglutarate so important? Because alpha-ketoglutarate is fundamental in catalyzing as a cofactor very important genes, like in this case, TAT. TAT takes 5-methylcytosine to 5-hydroxymethylcytosine, and it can be the methylation step. But if you inhibit TAT proteins, you alter the CpG ligands methylation. That in turn alters the gene expression and differentiation. That I think is fundamental because the level of alpha-ketoglutarate, whether it's high or low, would change that. And it would then change the gene expression and differentiation, which I think could be one of the key steps we're talking about in this interaction between the microbiome and our tissues. Alpha-ketoglutarate is not just a cofactor for TAT. It is cofactor for histomethylation, which can change the chromatin structure. It is a cofactor for pyrohydroxylation, which can change collagen folding. It is a cofactor for pyrohydroxylation, which can lead to the degradation of HIF-1 alpha, which is a key transcription factor for hypoxia. All of these, I can imagine, are important, but all of these depends on alpha-ketoglutarate. In fact, there are 60 of these enzymes which are important. So how do I know it is so important that it changes your health? It's so important it changes your health because these two enzymes are singled out in the metabolic pathway to be mutated. And when they mutated, they cause cancer. Not mild cancers, acute myeloblastic leukemia. Very, very devastating leukemia. Gliomas, very, very devastating cancers. And lymphomas and other chondrosarcoma, cholangiocarcinomas. They're so important that when they're mutated, as you can see here in secondary glioblastoma, they do not need to mutate the tumor suppressor genes and the oncogenes, the usual suspects, which are really important, P10, EGFR, PDGFR, these are causing majority of the cancers. But they do not need to be mutated when isocitrate dehydrogenase is mutated. In other words, that in itself can reprogram the cell. Secondary glioblastoma and primary glioblastoma, the best neuropathologists in the world cannot tell the difference. So what does that mutation do? We and Agios and Craig Thompson's group discovered that mutation is a new enzyme. It's an enzyme never existed in the germline of any animal. The wild type takes alpha isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate. The mutant takes alpha-ketoglutarate to 2-hydroxyglutarate. This enzyme does not exist. We do not need 2-hydroxyglutarate. 2-hydroxyglutarate is a toxin, and it's bad. Because 2-hydroxyglutarate, the similarity to the structure of alpha-ketoglutarate, blocks alpha-ketoglutarate as a coenzyme in these dioxygenases, 60 of them. In the brain tumor patients, they have 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 times more 2-hydroxyglutarate. They do something. So what do they do? So in order to look at the problem, our laboratory knocked in into the brain the mutation and also into the hematopoietic cells. So look at the hematopoietic cells. Right off the bat, you can see something's happening. If you knock this mutation of isocitrate dehydrogenase into the hematopoietic cells, you get large spleen, extramedullary hemopoiesis, anemia, hypocellularity, and increased in progenitor cells. What happens? What happens is because 2-hydroxyglutarate can block alpha-ketoglutarate. Alpha-ketoglutarate is key to the step in which TAT is changed from 5-methylcytosine to 5-hydroxymethylcytosine. This leads to reprogramming your epigenetic genome. That can be what it is. In fact, you can see that in the knock-in, you have increase in hypermethylation. It can also change the chromatin structure through directly changing the level of histomethylation by increasing the level of histones for particular, whatever it is, in this case, H3K4 trimethylase. So you can see how this can actually be involved. And in fact, what that leads to is it leads to a 1,500 changes in the hematopoietic stem cells. Those 1,500 changes, half of them overlap with those changes seen in acute myeloblastic leukemia patients. That is not an accident. That is a program. And this particular p-value tells you that means business. So although in normal situations you have 2-hydroxy alpha-ketoglutarate, the level of which, high or low, changes these different kinds of reactions, which can reprogram your cell at many different levels. What we prove it is important is that the mutation create an oncometabolite which only function is to block alpha-ketoglutarate from doing what it's supposed to do. But in your case, I don't think we're talking about 2-hydroxyglutarate. Maybe we are. We will see a little bit. So but in this case, what we're talking about is leukemia, which can lead to a symmetric cell division instead of asymmetric. Asymmetric will allow you to differentiate from hematopoietic stem cells into a granulocyte. If you keep having symmetric, then you build up precursor cells. You build up precursor cell that can lead to secondary mutations. And you see here that isocitric dehydrogen actually represents about 10 to 15% of all acute myeloblastic leukemia mutations. It can combine with other mutations which will cause you the leukemia, as we have suggested. But one enzyme that is never mutated when isocitric mutated is TAT2. That tells you that it is doing the job down the TAT2 pathway, which is of course involved in 5-hydroxymethylcytosine methylation. And if you combine this to this, what happens is you get frank leukemia. Here is the mouse, just isocitric dehydrogenase mutation. Here is FLT3. You combine the two. In 3 months, you have frank leukemia. Now, we collaborated with the French lymphoma group. Philippe Goulard is the key person there. And we discovered, in collaboration with the French lymphoma group, that this mutation and TAT2 are also mutated in certain kinds of lymphomas. And this is the papers. Rob Karen's in our lab, and François Lemonnier was in Philippe Goulard's lab, but she's now in Toronto. So these are important in these types of cancers. So the question is, is this reprogramming reversible? Because it's really nice, you get nice papers, you get to go to Paris, you talk, but are you doing anything for the patients? So Agios developed an inhibitor that blocked the mutant and therefore blocks and reduces the level of 2-hydroxyglutarate, Will you bring the patient back to life from the dying bed? Well, this is the second patient treated. Patient started with 80% blast. We're given inhibitor to isocitrate dehydrogenase 2. Within 2 weeks, it went into complete remission. Interestingly, you see the white blood cells going up. So suggesting in this case, you are not killing the leukemia cells. You're inducing them to differentiate. By reprogramming the epigenome, because now you reduce the level of 2-hydroxyglutarate, the oncometabolite. Well, one swallow does not make a spring. How about 7 swallows? How about 6 swallows? So in 6 out of the 7 patients that are evaluable, 3 went into complete remission within 1 month. 2 went into partial complete remission only because their platelets did not recover to the high level of 100,000, which is considered as true complete remission. They reached about 80,000. We have won all the battles. One patient completely ignored it, even though the 2-hydroxyglutarate were gone. But what we're talking about here is that the level of alpha-ketoglutarate, whether as in a wild-type situation or inhibited in the case of a mutation, producing 2-hydroxyglutarate, which can then block alpha-ketoglutarate functions, is that they are involved in a lot of enzyme reaction, transamination, porohydroxylation, the methylations, methylation of DNA, and methylation of histones. I think this is what we're talking about, at least partially. Okay. Now, there was this really curious paper just came out, and I'm still shocked. I'm trying to repeat it so I will not be able, because I haven't been able to sleep. What this paper said was that in breast cancer, the level of MYC correlates with the level of 2-hydroxyglutarate, which is the oncometabolite. They suggested that isocitrate can actually be taken to 2-hydroxyglutarate by perhaps isocitrate dehydrogenase 2. So that means that maybe this mutant was just a very highly active form of taking alpha-ketoglutarate to 2-hydroxyglutarate. And if that's the case, then there are more ways of regulating alpha-ketoglutarate and how they can or may not be able to reprogram your cell. And of course, you can think of a lot of different other ways of regulating alpha-ketoglutarate in addition to converting for isocitric. It can be converted by glutamate. And interestingly, this are the cofactors NADH and NAD. Of course, they're involved in a lot of different enzyme reactions. But notice that in germ-free mice, the ratio of these are dramatically changed. Can they be important? I don't know. But it's my speculation. Because there are other kinds of explanation. Butyric acid can be inhibitor to HDAC, which are involved in acetylation. So, I mean, the final 10 minutes, let me go back to the inflammation part of it, how the microbiome actually involves inflammation. So this is a kind of what is called a blue sky thinking, right? So immune cells. Now immune cells make immunoglobulin, but I think particularly I like to think about immunoglobulin IgM and IgA. They are involved in controlling the level of microbes, because IgA is mostly in your gut. And IgM is mostly involved in controlling the level of microbes. We're not talking about pathogenic. Because pathogenic is being considered and being acted upon by IgG, because they are more fine, you have higher level. But the level of IgM, IgA, is enormous. You don't think about it. It's 1.5 to 2 milligram per mil of IgM in your blood. It's only several times lower than IgG. Okay. They control microbes, which are just there, and because microbes, we heard, give you PAMs, and PAMs give you inflammation. So this interaction at the level which I talked to you earlier was at the level of nutrients and how they can reprogram. This next level is at the level of inflammation. And here's the blood that goes along immune cells. This is one thing we actually never really think very carefully about, is the immune reaction ever, never happens in the blood. It's like a police seeing a bad guy on the highway. There is no shooting there. It has to force the bad guy into the police station. Because you cannot be shooting on the highway because the highway goes through Paris. How would you like to be shot at with the apartment next to the highway? So that transport into the lymph node on the endothelium is very important. And that's controlled by the immune system at some level to identify, and the microbe has to play a role in that. So we stumble upon this a little bit. This is 1998. There's a paper by a group in Stanford. They published a molecule which they call Toso. And Toso actually is a sake that drink only on New Year's Day. If you haven't drank it, don't worry about it. It tastes really bad. That's why it's only drank on New Year's Day, because you don't want to drink the rest of the 364 days. So this says the Toso involved in blocking cell death. So a French-Canadian student, Louis-Martin Bouchard, made a knockout mouse of this 15 years ago. No phenotype whatsoever. What is it doing? Cell death, killing, et cetera, is the same. Hemopoiesis is the same. They're fertile. So meanwhile, there's a few little kind of papers that came across. It's overexpressed in lymphomas. It's overactivated T cells. But it's the IgM Fc receptor. So it binds to IgM. And remember, IgM is involved in controlling the level of microbes together with IgA. Okay. So these are the papers that said they bind to IgM. And I think it's important at some level. So now, fast forward later, 10 years, a couple of German postdocs came in, and they treated the mouse with TNF to trigger severe damage. And they found that the mouse are resistant to septic shock. And therefore, as a result, the level of liver enzymes is down. So it turned out it is very important for autoimmune disease. So Toso minus mouse, we tested them for collagen-induced arthritis, ovalbumin-induced asthma, experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis, type 1, type 2 diabetes, colitis, and they do not get collagen-induced arthritis. They do not get asthma, measuring the level of IL-5, and the eosinophils. they do not or get very little experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis, which is a model for multiple sclerosis. And reason is that dendritic cells cannot be activated. So the dendritic cells without TOSO cannot be activated whether you use wild-type T cells or TOSO T cells. And the dendritic cells can only be partially activated by LPS and CPG. So this, without TOSO, these dendritic cells actually are quite inert. In fact, if you activate them, instead of activating T cells to mount an immune response, you activate PD-L1 and FOXP3, which are, of course, signals for the immune system to shut down. So without TOSO, the dendritic cells, not activating the activation of the T cells to mount its immune response, it activates inertness at different levels. And as a result, you have higher level of Tregs. Now, I think this is very important, and the picture is worth 1,000 words. Without TOSO, the immune cells cannot get into the inflamed site. In other words, without TOSO, the police, after having identified the bad guy, cannot drag him into the police station. That results in no T cells and no macrophages in the CNS. These mice do not get arteriosclerosis. You can see here using the TOSO crossing to the LDL receptors. They do not get full colitis. In the DSS, we saw a lot of data the last 2 days, DSS induced colitis in these mice. Without TOSO, it is partially rescued. And the colon length is longer, reflecting indeed that they do not get as much inflammation. So inflammation, diabetes, we also heard a lot of talks. And I do not need to introduce you to inflammation and type 2 diabetes, and it's involved in the metabolic state, to the moderate state, to the modified milieu, and to the maintenance. Involved in cytokines that are secreted, and I think that could be very important. So these mice, when you challenge them with glucose or with insulin, they have very good responses to reduce the amount of glucose. In other words, they do not have glucose intolerance. Why? Because they make a lot of IgA and they make a lot of IgM. And IgA and IgM are involved in controlling the microbiota in the gut and in your blood. They keep them down because there are more of them. In fact, there are 3 times more IgA and 2 times more IgM. This translates to 3 to 4 milligrams per mil in your blood. That is a high level, but no change in the other Igs. So it is not just the whole shebang of immunoglobulin. It is selected for some kinds of immune response. And guess what? The macrophages do not get into the fat. If they cannot get into the fat, they cannot activate inflammation And so, where is it in the beginning? I think this is involved in controlling the microbiota, because they control the level of IgG and IgM and IgA only. It is not an immune response which is against a pathogen, because that would increase in IgG. In this case, we have IgA and IgM increased by 3-4-fold or 2-fold. So TOSO is involved in controlling. When TOSO is down, IgG, IgA is up. That controls more microbe, and the microbe are all probably playing a tonic signal to allow the immune cells to get into the endothelium. And if they cannot get into the endothelium, they cannot activate as PAMs, and the immune system is down. So that we are. I hope I've been able to tell you a couple of stories, mostly speculation. But it's nice to have speculation at the end of 2 days of solid good data and very, very important insights. And these are the people I have to thank. These are the people who work on isocitrate dehydrogenase in France. I want to point out François Lemonnier in collaborating with Philippe Goulart, the French Society of Lymphoma, which will actually bring me back to France in a couple of months in Bordeaux, where we have fine wine. Actually, my wine is actually Burgundy, but I would drink Bordeaux. You can see a lot of Europeans here, Carl, Philip Leonard, Dirk Branham, and Brussel, these involved in doing the TOSO work. Swiss, Italians. So we love and welcome scholars and students and postdocs to come visit us, stay for a while, or stay for a long time. Thank you very much.